You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll talk about NSA leaker Edward Snowden and his effort to get asylum in another country.
But first, it's biking season in Wisconsin. With decent weather out there, a lot of people are hitting the streets and the trails. But sometimes bikes, cars, and pedestrians have a hard time getting along. Joining us to discuss some important safety tips is Dave Schlabowski with the Bike Federation of Wisconsin. He joins us today from Milwaukee. Dave, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on the show.
Now, I understand the number of bicycle traffic fatalities is pretty small compared to vehicles, but I gather bike deaths are already higher than what happened last year. What's going on there?
Well, you know, the numbers are so small that it's really difficult to draw, you know, year-to-year conclusions about safety and things like that. Obviously, a single death is one too many, and we certainly don't want that to happen, and there are ways that people can ride more safely. But I'd just like to say, I mean, if you look at the fatal crashes over the last 10 years, they always fluctuate between 12 and 8 or something like that. But the overall crash rate has been for bicycles versus cars has been on a consistent decline for like the last 15 years or so in Wisconsin. Bicycling keeps getting safer. It is a really safe thing to do in general. There are some things, though, that we can all do to make it safer for everybody.
Well, let's jump in on that point. I know you look at bike accidents, car, bike, bike, pedestrian. What are some common themes? Like if we all just did blank, we could cut those numbers even further?
Well, the first and probably most important and perhaps obvious is that if everybody fares best when we all, no matter what vehicle we're in, we're walking or we're riding a bike or we're driving a car, when we all obey the rules of the road. So that means, you know, if you're in a car, it means, you know, driving a speed limit and yielding to pedestrians at crosswalks and passing bicycles with 3 feet. If you're on a bike, it means going the same direction as traffic is supposed to go in the lane. You don't ever ride against traffic. Riding is reasonably close to the right side of the road. Stopping at red lights, things like that. It, you know, if you're a pedestrian, you should cross at a corner if at all possible, you know, and if not, you don't have a right to jump out of the road. Cars don't have to look out for you in the middle of the street. You have to look out for them. They have to look out for you if you're in a crosswalk. But so that's the first thing. You know, we should all do a better job of you know, paying attention to the task at hand, no matter what vehicle we're in.
Now, I see a lot of times when these issues come up in the news, if you read a comment section or do a call-in show, say, there's a lot of blame game going on. The drivers are mad at the bicyclists and vice versa, and the mm-hmm. pedestrians are bugged yeah. by them both. It sounds like you're taking a more of a we're all in this together kind of approach.
Well, in my previous job, I worked for the City of Milwaukee Department of Public Works, and as part of that, I was in charge of a program we called the Neighborhood Traffic Management, where I fielded complaints about speeding on residential streets, about cars not letting people cross, about bicycles, you know, not stopping at red. I was the complaint department.
Uh-huh. So. That must have been fun.
Yeah, right. It's a great job. But actually, I learned, I work in the Department of Public Works, and I work very closely with the traffic engineering section, and I learned to look at facts and figures and do studies before we did knee-jerk reactions to any sort of complaint about a traffic safety issue. So the first thing we'd do is we'd do studies. You know, somebody says everybody's speeding on my block. Well, we put out a speed detector and we check how many cars are really speeding. Sometimes they were right, you know, lots of people were, and other times it was maybe, you know, not as bad of a problem as they reported. We would get complaints about bicycles going through red lights at intersections. So we'd send out an intern, they'd sit there with a traffic counter and they'd click how many people were riding on the sidewalk when they shouldn't, how many ran red lights and all that sort of stuff. We did counts at crosswalks where pedestrians said, I can't get across the street, no cars will yield to me, you know, so we would count the cars and count, you know, how many times they yielded to pedestrians. And in my experience has been that no matter what mode of transportation people take, a certain percentage of people are going to break the laws that they know they can get away with breaking safely if it gets them from point A to point B faster. So if you're in a car, you're going to drive over the speed limit a little bit. If you're on a bike and nobody's at a red light, You might run that red light. If you're a pedestrian and you're walking and it says don't walk, but there aren't any cars, you might cross anyway. So I understand the acrimony between the different groups, but we all wear these same hats. I drive a car, I ride a bike, and I walk. So, I guess it all depends on what perspective what hat you're wearing at the time you want to complain.
When you look at communities around the state, are there a couple things that are proven, I guess, interventions from local, county, even state governments when they imposed this, when they made this change, it really seemed to help things out?
Well, sure. There are a number of things. I mean, with any traffic safety thing, there's several E's. There's education, there's engineering, there's encouragement, and there's enforcement. So you want to make sure people are educated. At the Wisconsin Bike Fed, we teach thousands of kids in our Safe Routes to School every year. We teach adults. We have a Share and Beware program where we go out to things like county fairs and we provide safety information about all forms of transportation, walking and biking, share the rules of the road. So that education component is important. We work with driver's ed instructors to get, the safety information to them, too. So education in communities that do more education tend to have, better, compliance with the rules of the road. We don't have any mandatory classes to teach people the rules of the road that apply to bicycling, so some people don't know them. The general rule is that most rules that apply to cars apply to bikes. There's a few exceptions, but that's the general rule. But a lot of people don't know that. They think they should ride the opposite way. That's not the case. You should never do that. It's illegal and it's far more dangerous. So education counts. Enforcement, communities that have more enforcement, that helps. About speeding, you can go to the Dells. It's really easy to walk across the street as busy as it is in traffic-wise in the Dells. It's really cars yield to you because the Dells has had a big campaign. Tourists are important. Lots of them walk around, so they've had a big campaign to get that word out, enforce it, encourage people to yield to pedestrians in a crosswalk. So those sorts of things help. Communities that build bicycle facilities tend to have more people riding, and when you have more people riding, you have fewer crashes. So, the communities like Madison have percentage-wise much lower crash rates than communities that don't have as many bike lanes or trails, things like that.
And just to wrap up, how are we doing? You mentioned bike lanes in cities. How are we doing on bike lanes and trails along rural highways, county highways?
That's getting much better. The Wisconsin Department of Transportation is doing a real good job of adding, wider shoulders when they're reconstructing roads. It may not be marked as a bike facility, but it has multiple benefits. So a slightly wider shoulder reduces, crashes for all vehicles, motor vehicles as well as bicycles, but it also provides people walking in those rural communities where maybe a sidewalk or an actual bike path isn't necessary. A 4-foot shoulder, provides that little space where people feel safer and it reduces conflicts. So the DOT has been doing that kind of as a matter of course on many of their projects. Many local smaller communities are starting to see the value of this as well. I've been vacationing up in Vilas County since I was a little kid, and it's still the musky capital of the world, don't get me wrong, but I tell you what, when you are on Main Street down in Boulder Junction, there are just as many bikes and bike racks on those cars as there are trailer hitches with boats. And why is that? Because Vilas County's built this wonderful trail system up there that everybody likes to ride. So you're going to go up to Vilas County, you're still going to go fishing, and you're going to enjoy all the Northwoods things, fish fries and supper clubs that everybody goes to the Northwoods to enjoy. But people also go there to ride bikes and to go to coffee shops and stuff like that. So our rural communities are starting to see the value of adding these facilities, and many of them are doing it with some of their own money as well as with a combination of federal money.
Dave, that's a great place to leave it. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, thank you.
That was Dave Schlabowski, Interim Director of the Bike Federation of Wisconsin. Coming up next, Edward Snowden, the man who released government surveillance secrets, is on the run. He's seeking asylum in another country. We'll talk about what he's facing and the politics involved. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Edward Snowden's search for asylum continues. The 30-year-old whistleblower spoke up today from his location at a Moscow airport, saying he's free to publish more about surveillance programs in the U.S. and that he's being illegally persecuted.
But more and more countries have turned down his request for asylum, and Russia says he can't stay unless he stops publishing those secrets. So what's next for Snowden, and what exactly does it mean to get political asylum?
Joining us now is Olga Hazan, global editor at The Atlantic. Olga, welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, we've been hearing a lot about Edward Snowden's attempts to seek out a country that'll take him in, but what exactly does it mean to have political asylum?
Sure. Well, that means being kind of a refugee type person, and it means that you're fleeing from persecution, that you feel like you might be persecuted for your political beliefs rather than for some crime that you've committed. So he's trying to make the argument that these leaks were sort of a part of political advocacy on his part, and that if he were sent back, that the kind of charges against him and the trial would be kind of unfair, or that it wouldn't match the severity of his crime.
Now, so far, he's been turned down by a slew of countries, and we're not sure where he's going to end up. What makes his case difficult at this point?
Well, what makes it difficult is that, there's a lot of factors, obviously, but one thing is that the U.S. is sort of seems to be kind of putting some pressure on certain countries to kind of keep them from taking him in. So, for example, Vice President Biden spoke with Ecuador's president to sort of remind him about some preferential trade agreements so that they would be less likely to grant him asylum. It's also going to be tough for him to make the claim that he's part of like a protected group or some sort of class that, you know, is unfairly persecuted in the United States, as opposed to just someone who has committed a crime. There's a lot of sort of political issues at play here, so it's not really a straightforward legal case. And then there's the fact that he's sort of trapped in the airport, and it's going to be tough for him to get to a country, one of these countries that say that, you know, he would have to actually be on their territory in order to file an asylum application.
Now, it's interesting because it seems to me that the U.S. has been kind of playing it cool on this one. We haven't acted overly eager to get him back. President Obama has been saying it's not his top priority. And yet, Snowden seems to be getting blocked at a lot of turns. So what do you think is happening backstage?
You know, I'm not entirely sure, but I think a part of the reason is that nobody wants to seem desperate here to get him, right? I mean, Obama has said that he doesn't want to go, you know, send jets, you know, going to get a 29-year-old hacker. I think part of it is just posturing. Like, Putin is also acting very nonchalant about the whole thing, saying, you know, he's welcome to stay. He just has to stop the leaks. So I think eventually just someone is going to give in, or, you know, he's going to find himself that he's out of options and that he's been in the airport for too long and going to be sent home.
Do you have a sense of what the status of Snowden's relationship with Russia is at this point, since that's where he is?
Of Snowden's, well, yeah, I have no idea, because it seems like at first he almost wanted to stay there, that he had submitted an asylum application, but he recently he withdrew his request because it seems like he wants to continue with these activities with whistleblowing and with exposing various government injustices. Or what he perceives as injustices. It seems like that relationship has sort of, you know, soured, and it seems to go that way on behalf of the Russian government as well. And then there's the fact that Russia might want to, you know, interrogate him in some way or to get some information from him. So they might also be interested in keeping him there a while longer just to see what he knows.
And yet he's got some support in Russia. It sounds like he's got some of Russia's political players and intelligentsia saying, you know, what's the big deal? You know, the U.S. doesn't have that great a relationship with Russia anyway. Why don't we just let him stay?
Right, exactly. And for a lot of Russians, this kind of shows, I mean, this sort of plays into the idea that, you know, whenever Russia is criticized in the American media, there's always sort of this, what about the U.S. and what about, bad things that America has done. So this is sort of one example of that, where it's like, oh, well, look, you know, he's shining a light on all of these misdeeds. So, you know, we should grant him political asylum just to show our support for, you know, kind of casting our you know, Americans in a bad light. And, you know, but I think there was someone quoted in the Daily Beast, actually, the chairperson of the Civil Support Committee there, who said that she only can think of one person who's been granted political asylum in Russia, and that's the former Azerbaijani president. So it seems like even though there might be a lot of support for this, there's maybe not a whole lot of precedent for granting this kind of asylum for people like Snowden.
Well, it sounds like at this point, Venezuela is the leading contender to take Snowden in. Now, this is a country with a brand new leader after lots of years under Hugo Chavez, and the relationship between Venezuela and the U.S. is a little strained. So how big of a political statement would it be if Venezuela did take Snowden in?
Yeah, I mean, I think, we can't really know whether or not this is just sort of posturing or not until he actually is able to get there and you know, they either accept or reject his asylum claim. But, I mean, so Venezuela has sort of a history of tension with the U.S., but it, you know, Maduro has been sort of reiterating his offer of asylum, and, you know, but I feel like there's not a lot of support from the Venezuelan people for taking in Snowden. And so we can't actually know how that will pan out until he actually submits his application there.
Do you ever think about what his life must be like right now, holed up in a Moscow airport? He's on the run. He doesn't know where he's going. He must be under tremendous stress. What do you think is going through his mind?
You know, I think that's a really interesting part of this. There actually have been cases of other people having to live in airports for a while when they were seeking asylum. Of course, the joke that everyone kind of made when this whole thing happened was the parallels to the movie The Terminal with Tom Hanks. That was an Iranian, based on the story of an Iranian man who lived in the Paris airport for a really long time. But, you know, there have been other cases, including, you know, Chinese dissidents who have spent time in various airports and people who have been turned away by countries where they were seeking asylum. I imagine it must be incredibly stressful and incredibly mentally taxing. And, you know, he also recently he wrote that statement, you know, that was posted on the WikiLeaks website yesterday. And, you know, some people speculated that it didn't seem like maybe he had written it because there were some elements of it that didn't sound like maybe an American would have written it. So we don't know if maybe he's sort of like allowing WikiLeaks to kind of advocate on his behalf in some ways, or whether he's still totally in control of his own situation.
And he was hoping to get to Ecuador, right, where Julian Assange, WikiLeaks founder, is right now, and I guess that didn't pan out.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, Assange has been in Ecuador's London embassy, and I think it was Assange who initially pressured Ecuador's president, Rafael Correa, to accept Snowden. And it did seem like for a while they were going to. But I think just today or yesterday they came out and said that the assistance that they had sort of offered him, they had given him some temporary travel documents because the U.S. had taken away his passport. And so they described doing this as a mistake. And they said that he couldn't travel to Ecuador without his passport. And, you know, I think that phone call from Biden really did make a difference. So this is maybe kind of showing that although countries might in theory support this idea of whistleblowing or exposing, you know, surveillance and things like that, ultimately they don't want to kind of tweak the U.S. too much or ruin relations too much, especially on behalf of someone who represents kind of this rogue kind of trend of you know, of leakers coming from inside agencies and exposing government misdeeds. You know, maybe they don't necessarily want to side with WikiLeaks over the U.S.
Oh, we've got just about a minute left here, but what do you think will happen if nobody steps up to take Edward Snowden in? What happens then?
I mean, I really have no idea. Your guess is as good as mine, but I think, you know, he could try to stay in Russia. Russia doesn't have an extradition treaty with the U.S., so he could stay there and Russia could just refuse to extradite him. He could end up in a place like Iceland that's, you know, been kind of friendly to leakers in general, and to WikiLeaks in particular. He could end up in a place like Venezuela. I mean, there have been past cases of Americans who have sought asylum in various countries, and they grant them this kind of political asylum, or they don't extradite them because of various kind of exemptions and sort of specific elements of their extradition treaties that they point to, saying, "Oh, we can't send them back because espionage is not in our extradition treaty." So that's how Bobby Fischer ended up, dying in Iceland and not in the U.S.
Well, it's one that we'll all be watching closely. Olga, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
That was Olga Hazan, global editor at The Atlantic.
Coming up tomorrow afternoon on Central Time, we'll get ready for the 4th of July with a look at fireworks laws in Wisconsin and how different the laws and the enforcement are in different parts of the state.
That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Okay, raise your hand if you've ever had a boss you couldn't stand.
Now, keep it raised if you've ever dreamed about a job where nobody's in charge, no managers, no hierarchy, no boss.
Well, it turns up, you can put your hands down now, especially if you're driving. It turns out that some companies are doing away with bosses and trading them in for a more community-driven workplace.
Here to discuss that trend is author Matthew Scher. He's the author of the best-selling ebook, The Sinking of the Bounty. Say that again, The Sinking of the Bounty. His recent article is called The Boss Stops Here, and it appeared in New York Magazine. Thanks for joining us, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Matt, in 1980, less than 20% of the companies on the Fortune 1000 list had a team management structure, and now that number is up to 80%. So what do you say is going on here in the trend to ditch the boss in favor of the team?
Well, a big part of what's happening is a new generation is entering the workplace, and I should specify before we talk more about this, that bossless doesn't necessarily mean no leadership. In most of these companies, it's a team-based effort. Work is divided into teams, self-governing teams, but there's still leadership of a sort, so it's not a Lord of the Flies situation. But to answer your question, I think what's happening is you have a lot more 20-somethings and 30-somethings entering the workplace, and studies have generally shown the younger workers tend to work better in a collaborative environment, tend to work better without too much kind of top-down, very strict management, and especially in creative industries like software design, which is the kind of work that the company I profiled in this story does. Teams can perform, tend to perform better than individuals in sort of siloed environments, to steal a term from the management handbook.
Well, you profiled that Ann Arbor company, Ann Arbor, Michigan, a company called Menlo, and they use this team model walking in the door. I mean, did it seem like a different place to be?
Oh, it didn't. And I will admit to feeling a little bit jealous and a little suspicious at the same time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that most of the people at Menlo that I spoke to were incredibly happy for the very reasons that you'd expect, that they do have a lot more freedom than the average office worker. But they were also very honest about the fact that in a team, there are still pressures. In a team-based, bossless environment, there are still pressures. They're just different kind of pressures.
And so how does a group like that, composed of all these people comprising a team with more or less equal weight, how do they come to decisions?
Basically what happens is a client will approach Menlo and say, "I want you to build a piece of software for me." And a team of Menlo employees, and I should take a step back here and say that Menlo conducts all hiring and firing itself. So in other words, the Menlo employees essentially vote in who works at the company and vote out people who don't work at the company anymore. So they handle all the hiring and firing. Anyway, the client will come to this team and say, "We need this built," and the team will meet at the beginning of every week to kind of dole out individual software building tasks among the team members, and then they'll meet at the end of the week again to discuss progress. And it's all self-governing and self-monitoring, so the team as a whole in these meetings decides what needs to be done.
We're talking to Matthew Scher about his article, The Boss Stops Here, and we'd like to hear from you, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Have you worked in a team environment at a company of some sort? Have you worked in a cooperative or collective with no boss? What worked for you? What didn't work for you? 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. So, Matthew, when you're watching these folks work in a team approach, does it seem like they do things faster because they don't need to keep checking in with the boss? Or does it seem like they work slower because they got to all weigh in on something?
Yeah, you got it. I mean, it's much slower. And this is the major downside in the companies that I talk about in the article. To a company, every company said the same thing, that the work process does necessarily slow. If you have a boss who orders you to do something, says, we need this done right now, you're going to do it, and you're going to do it quickly. That, obviously, in a bossless environment, you lose that top-down ethos, and instead everything has to be discussed as a team. Now, the argument from somebody working at a bossless company would be that, well, everything is done much better than it would be and much more creatively because we have the leeway to get creative. But certainly it is much slower, and these meetings that I spoke about at the beginning and end of every week do drag on. I mean, we're talking a 2.5-3 hour meeting. So, yes, it does take more time.
You know, I was thinking about how we get satisfaction in our jobs, and one of them is mastery, getting really good at something. And another is getting that pat on the head from the boss saying, good job. Maybe you get singled out at a meeting and that makes you feel good. How do you, if you work in one of these team environments, how do you get job satisfaction? Where does it come from?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, the satisfaction comes from a totally different place. It comes from having built a product that the client likes. Now, this seems on the face of it sort of ridiculous, but again, it goes back to this, the type of people who work in these environments. They tend to prize creativity and sort of intellectual endeavor over, you know, ladder climbing. Ladder climbing, if you work at a company like this, you're not going to be interested in getting the corner office because there is no corner office. You're going to be interested in coming in to work and building something of value, which is also why, you know, in the millennial generation, when we read studies about the millennial generation, there's this feeling that workers in their 20s and 30s get satisfaction from a different place than workers did, let's say, 20 or 30 years ago.
When they're hiring, how do they make sure that the person is a good fit, that they're not getting those ladder climbers that you mentioned?
It's a multi-step process, and it can take up to a month before someone is brought on full-time. Basically, what happens is it's like speed dating. You think about a speed dating environment where a person would bounce from individual to individual, and that happens at Menlo Innovations as well. A person will come in and code with another employee for, let's say, 5 minutes, and then hop to the next one. And then at the end of that whole process, once all the musical chairs is done, the Menlo employees will get together and discuss who worked and who didn't. And they say that they've been pretty successful in finding team players that way.
They ever get any, I don't know, bad eggs is the right word, but people who just don't get it, because it's a mind shift.
It's totally a mind shift. And yes, I think that they would say they do. And what happens, as I mentioned, they hire and fire as a team cooperatively, so they have had to let people go. And I think their argument is that it happens less often than it would in a different kind of environment, because everyone is very carefully vetted to make sure they work well in teams. Kindergarten skills is what they call it.
But when it comes down to it, I mean, it's got to be heartbreaking, maybe more so in a team approach, when not only is the guy you work next to being fired, but it's not the boss's fault. You were one of the people who helped pull the trigger there.
Yeah, and I think that it goes beyond that, in fact, to the way that you conduct yourself in an office in general. I mean, if you have only the boss to avoid, if you can duck into your cubicle when the boss is coming by, that's all well and good. I think a lot of us have had to deal with that before. But if you have if you've got a whole team of bosses and everybody is watching you and everybody will determine whether or not you stay, you're going to work much harder than you would if the boss was kind of tucked away in his corner office, not able to see you.
We're speaking with Matt Scher about the trend toward bossless offices. His recent article, The Boss Stops Here, was published in New York Magazine. Next, we'll check the headlines, and then we'll take your calls. Would your office, do you think, be better with fewer bosses? And do you have a job in maybe one of these alternative type work environments? What do you think? Are we ready to move toward this model? Would you want to work in one, given the opportunity? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or tell us your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking with Matthew Scherer right now about the new trend toward bossless work environments, a team approach. Advocates say they boost productivity and creativity. We want to know what you think. Do you think we need bosses to get the job done, or are they just another word for bottleneck? You can reach us at 800-642-1234. We can go to the phones right away. We've got Ed on the line in Madison. Ed, hi. Ed, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing today?
Real good. What do you think about this idea?
Well, I think it's a great idea, and we kind of operate along the same lines in the fact that we're an ESOP, so everybody takes ownership in it. So performance and productivity matters from everybody, from the janitor all the way to the branch manager. So, you know, because we're all sharing in the same pool, the same retirement pool that we own. So, you know, production and profitability matters to everybody. Now, again, we do have a management team, but quite often all they are is a liaison between the individual branches and corporate.
Gotcha. And Ed, I got to know, before I let you go, what does ESOP stand for?
Employee Stock Ownership Program.
Ownership Program. Gotcha. All right. Thank you so much for the call, Ed. Does that sound like it's in the ballpark of what you're writing about, Matthew?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I think that that gets into something a little bit different, which is employee ownership. Mm-hmm. And it's worth, or at least an employee financial stake in the company. It's interesting to note that a lot of these companies that are doing bossless, team-based environments are not employee-owned. They're software companies where the work is done collectively, but profits are not shared. But yeah, I mean, it does sound like something that it does sound familiar. And I also would point out again that as the caller mentioned, in a lot of these cases, you do have bosses of a kind, and you have liaisons between the teams and clients. It's just that the creative work itself is done without bosses and is done on a team basis.
All right, thanks for that call. And we go next to Frank, joining us from Appleton. Hi, Frank.
Hi.
Hey, what's on your mind?
Well, I work in a corporate office currently. I have supervisors and floor advisors, things like that. I'm on bonus or compensation. I do have a base pay. And what I've realized is that there are personnel within my same building area who are on salary or get paid an hourly wage for their benefits of employment there. And I really find it, because my salary depends on how well I perform my job, I really find that the supervisors being close to me or the floor assistants being close to me, in that regard, I can glean more from them, making my productivity better because my work directly reflects on my wages, per se, when I think that a lot of people who maybe are working on a salary, I think that's depending, in the last segment you all mentioned on productivity of the employee themselves. I think that has a lot to do with whether or not someone's going to be more productive or less productive is how directly affected their salary is according to their production.
And you're saying you're more motivated because you've got supervisors there.
Well, absolutely, because my salary is based on my performance alone. So if I can glean from my supervisors, I take advantage of their knowledge, their wisdom from being there for a long period of time, plus they can coach me in maybe what I need to do better in my position, therefore increasing my own benefits, my own salary.
Well, that's an interesting take. Thank you so much, Frank. And what do you think, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's certainly true that that is something that bosses provide for us, isn't it? I mean, they provide not just feedback, but if we do trust them, if they are people who have made great strides in the industry we're in, it's nice to have them around sometimes. I would say that that's not always the case, of course, and often what can happen is when there's too much middle management, and that's often what we're talking about in situations like this, the sort of, you know, office space-like cliche of the middle manager constantly leaning over your cubicle, that can become inhibiting on production. But certainly, yeah, I mean, bosses, there's a reason we have bosses.
Matt, when I first heard about the topic of your article, I first thought of things from the 60s, from the left, the co-ops, the collective businesses, a lot of them still persist here in Wisconsin to this day. This is coming from a very different perspective. Is there any overlap between the two? Was the corporate world inspired by that model from the left, or is this a parallel invention?
Well, I think this comes historically from, and I get into this a little bit in the article, but essentially when there's a large recession in the 80s, and we lost kind of naturally a lot of middle managers around the country. And with the absence of middle managers, people started thinking, well, this might work better than we thought it did. Now, certainly, yes, people do steal. When you visit these companies, they are very much influenced by cooperatives. But there's also a sense that technology companies, you think of a place like Google or Facebook, which allows employees so much free time to perform, has also influenced these companies to a large extent as well.
And let's go back to the phones now. We've got Marina from Pleasant Prairie with us. Hi, Marina.
Hello. Good afternoon to everyone.
Hi.
Listen, my question for your guest is an issue of diversity regarding teamwork. When you have a situation where they can decide who's hired, particularly who's hired, particularly in, say, like software, we do know that women are underrepresented. You have the same situation with African Americans. You could talk about, you're saying 20 to 30 year olds. What if you're in your 40s and 50s, have the same skill set? There are LGBTs, those type of things. How does that play? In his observation and looking at the companies that he was with, what was the diversity factor at those companies? Because historically you already have problems, okay, regarding employment and so on and so forth. But now you're talking about, you know, and you usually have to hit the hurdle regarding the resume, you know, and so on and so forth, and the interview and things like that. Now you're talking about you have to fit in to a group.
Right. So who's accountable? Who's accountable when you've got one of these big group environments? That's a great question. What do you think, Matt?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question. And I would say a couple of things. First of all, Menlo, which is the company that I spent the most time with, is not diverse in terms of age. Most people are in their 20s and 30s, but it is diverse in terms of race and gender. There were a lot of different backgrounds on that team, which leads me to believe that probably they did a pretty good job self-regulating in terms of diversity of hires. However, the caller is exactly right that there is a question about accountability. So, for instance, at Menlo, if there was ever a crime in the office, for instance, if there was ever an allegation of sexual harassment, that would be handled by the founder of the company. So the bosses are totally removed. There is still that layer for those kinds of instances. But in terms of diversity of hiring, I think the caller's right on. It's a fascinating question, and we'll probably see more of that and we'll probably be able to observe how that shakes out in coming years.
Matt, this team model that you looked at specifically at this company in Ann Arbor, it was, what, about 50 employees, a software company. Is this something that could apply to a bigger corporation or a manufacturing company, something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I went into this assuming that it could be only software, and then in the course of reporting the article, I found a tomato processor in California. Now, this seemed to defeat everything that I thought about the bossless environment, because this is a tomato processor where the workers are blue-collar. It's an extremely large company with thousands of employees. It's called Morningstar. It's in California. So obviously it can work. Of course, the Morningstar folks described the same sort of drawbacks that the Menlo people did. There was more creativity. People were happier in general, but sometimes things, especially hiring, firing, and resolving conflict, did take a bit longer.
You know, we've been looking at how creativity is so important. It's one of the driving forces behind these team environments. What's the evidence out there that these teams are spawning more creative stuff than the old hierarchical ways of doing things?
Well, there have been a few academic studies because this team environment is or purely bossless environments are relatively new. The studies are still being done, but there are a few studies that have been done by a guy named Stephen Courtwright, who's a professor out in Texas, which shows that on average, when you do have a team environment, productivity does tend to be higher and people do tend to be happier compared to environments where it's strictly top-down. And I can say that anecdotally in my own experience, speaking with folks at these different companies, that certainly people were happier and certainly that they were more proud of the products that they created, that they had fewer bugs, for instance, and that they were less prone to error when they worked in a team environment.
Did you get a sense that, or even maybe somebody said this directly to you, I wouldn't want to go back to having a boss, an old-fashioned hierarchy?
Yeah, I got that a lot, and actually, funnily enough, at Menlo, there were folks who had never worked in another job, and I met this guy who was in his early 20s, and he'd only come to work at Menlo, and he said to me, you know, shaking his head, he said, I can't imagine people, you know, they go to an office every day and they report to a boss. It boggled his mind. He clearly couldn't imagine it. So, yeah, I did hear that a lot.
Let's take one more quick caller. Tom from Rhinelander, if you could be brief, that would be great. Thanks. Hi, Tom.
I'll try. Thank you. Yeah, my experience in working with this is that it's not always cracked up to be sometimes. First of all, when management teams are developed and take on this so-called teaming, a lot of times it takes it on only in name and adopts all the language of teaming but doesn't really operate that way. The second observation is that a lot of times these meetings are a grand waste of time, trying to involve everybody to an extreme that really leads to mediocrity, not to greater product.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Tom. Those are some good points there. And yeah, the meetings, I usually don't run into many people who are a fan of three-hour-long meetings, but I don't know. How does it work out with these people?
Well, I think that you have to make a trade at a certain point. So you're a little, you know, you don't love sitting through three-hour-long meetings, but you also do love having more control over the product that you're building. But your last call is right. I mean, look, there are plenty of companies that can adopt the language and say, you know, we're a democratic company, but are not actually a democratic company. It's relatively easy to do that. But I think, just as a closing thought, that the companies that do actually see it through and do actually adopt a purely horizontal workplace, it does seem to work for them.
Matthew, right at the beginning, you mentioned that you felt a little jealous of the people at these places. Is this someplace, if you were in the right line of work, someplace you'd want to work?
Well, it's funny because I think journalism might be one of the last places where this could really totally work because it is so dependent on the editor-writer relationship. But, yeah, I mean, given the chance in another line of work, I'd jump at it.
Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, guys.
We've been speaking with author Matt Scherr. His recent article on Office Life Without Bosses appeared in New York Magazine, and you can find a link to it on the Central Time Facebook page.
After the news, we'll be launching one of our new segments. Is it going to be called Nerd Up? Is it going to be called Geek Out? We don't know yet. We'll be talking about that with our guest, Patrick Rothfuss, who has some distinct opinions on this.
Strong opinions.
Strong opinions. And we'll hear about that coming up. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. News is next here on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.